Well, this is a wonderful have you here, Senator, again. And this is actually a double feature this afternoon. And I have the privilege of also introducing to you our next speaker, U.S. Senator-elect Ted Cruz from Texas. It was 2 years ago when Ted Cruz came up to me and others in the room here, this room, said he was contemplating a run for the U.S. Senate and asked for reaction. Trying hard not to pour water over Ted's noble commitment to public service, I resisted the temptation to utter what instinctively would roll off of most of our tongues when a friend confronts us with such a request for advice. Are you crazy? Do you have a fever? Have you sought professional help for this deviant behavior? Taking a slightly different tack, I asked all the usual questions. Is it the right time politically? Do you really think the money is there? Is your family prepared for this? Have you checked all the necessary boxes back home in Texas? Now, as any of you who know Ted Cruz would guess, he responded to those questions looking rather reflective and discerning, but you knew just below the surface that Ted was optimistic and just raring to go. He wanted to do this. From his experiences with the Bush campaign and his bid for attorney general, he knew he was ready for the political fray. And while he probably was not sure whether the timing was right electorally, he probably knew from his experiences as Solicitor General of Texas, as an official in Washington during the Bush administration, and as a former law clerk to Chief Justice William Rehnquist, that it was important to get to the business of trying to defend our system of limited constitutional government in the halls of Washington sooner rather than later. By the end of the conversation, how could I be anything but thankful that he wanted to run and hopeful for success? Ted's drive, optimism, and zealous pursuit of public service out of a commitment to our Constitution paid off. With great sacrifice from him, his wife Heidi, and their family, Ted stands before us as the senator-elect from the state of Texas. And we are all the better for it because we have in the Senate a good man with extraordinary skill and intellect and with unparalleled and unflinching commitment to our Constitution of small and limited government. I have no doubt, that Ted Cruz will quickly emerge as one of Congress's key spokesmen and leaders for a revival for the structural Constitution, standing alongside, of course, Senator Mike Lee. Please extend a warm welcome to a longtime fellow Federalist, U.S. Senator-elect Ted Cruz of Texas.
Thank you very, very much. Thank you. Well, thank you, Leonard, for that very, very warm welcome. It is great to be back with family. Like many people in this room, I've grown up with the Federalist Society. This has been my home for my entire adult life, my entire professional life. Federalist Society, we're having our 30th anniversary now. I first became involved with this august group 20 years ago when I was a 1L in law school. At the time, I have to admit, 20 years ago, the Federalist Society already seemed this established major power, which probably reflects the naivete of a 1L. But it is truly breathtaking how we have journeyed together. You know, the first thing I have to say to everyone here, there are a lot of men and women in this room who believed in this crazy, improbable journey when no one in their right mind would have. Who expressed the same forbearance Leonard discussed, although I have to admit the "are you friggin' crazy" was implied. But Leonard's far too diplomatic to actually have said that out loud. Yet I have to tell you, 2 years ago, I sat in this room and listened to then brand new Senator Mike Lee stand and give a speech that was just jaw-dropping. Let me be very clear. There is no United States Senator, zero, in the U.S. Senate remotely like Mike Lee. And I'll tell you, afterwards, he and I went and visited. It was actually the first time we'd met. And we spent the next couple of hours debating constitutional law. We went back. When you just get elected and you're a brand new senator-elect, they give you a little office in the basement of the Capitol that is buried down in the bowels there. I can tell you, I'm pretty sure I saw a minotaur wandering around outside. But I spent a couple of hours with Mike walking around. I remember it was, in fact, this Friday, because it was the day his committee assignment requests were due. And so I walked with him to the Secretary of the Senate's office to hand in his request for committees. And I remember one of the things we were talking about at the time was the national debt, which was at the time $14 trillion. Ah, a few trillion ago. And it so happened the GAO had just come out with a report that estimated the value of all of the land owned by the United States government was right at $14 trillion. Now, that struck me as a fairly convenient equivalence, and I don't see any reason why the United States government should be the largest landowner in the world, and why it should own much of the United States west of the Mississippi. So we began discussing that, and it occurred to me that in Mike Lee, I was in the presence of a fellow traveler, in the presence of a fellow Federalist. Mike was the first major national figure to endorse my campaign right when we launched. And he was, remember, it was just a month or two later when we were visiting after a dinner, and we were talking about the Senate, and he said, well, what could I do to help? And I said, well, you could endorse me. And he said, yeah, I could do that. And then he looked over at his staff and said, I can do that, can't I? And they kind of looked at their shoes, and they didn't want to argue with their boss too much, so they're like, well, I guess you can. And so he jumped out and endorsed me when he hadn't been in the Senate 30 days. It was one of the first acts. It signified Mike Lee was not going to be a typical senator. When we started this campaign, when an awful lot of y'all jumped on board, when we started, I was quite literally at 2% in the polls. And the margin of error was 3%. Which, if my math serves me, means technically I could have been at negative 1%. It might have been the case that 1% of Texans would have gone to the polls and written in, not Cruz. And we went through a $50 million primary, most expensive primary in the entire country. I can tell you, you have not lived until you've had $35 million in nasty attack ads run against you. Midway through, my wife Heidi, watching one of the ads, turned to me and said, goodness gracious, I didn't realize you were such a rotten guy. We were outspent 3-1. In any other race, I should have been roadkill. I should have been an armadillo by the side of the freeway. For those of y'all who aren't Texans, you can go home and look it up. And we saw something extraordinary happen. We saw thousands and thousands of Republican women, of Tea Party leaders, of business leaders, of conservative activists all over the state of Texas come together, begin knocking on doors, begin making phone calls, begin reaching out to their friends. And we ended up going from 2% in the polls to not just winning that primary, but winning by 14 points. It was an incredible testament to the grassroots, to the way politics should be decided. Now, the main message I want to convey to folks today is a combination of retrospective and prospective. Retrospective, asking what the heck happened last Tuesday. on the election, because the election wasn't pretty. And prospective asking, where do conservatives go moving forward? And I actually think those two questions are closely intertwined. And I'm going to cut to the punchline first and then go back and get to there. The punchline is what the Federalist Society has done in the world of law in three decades has been extraordinary. In fact, Gene Meyer and I were just visiting right beforehand, and Gene kind of laughed and said, you know, when you and I visited and you said you were going to run 2 years ago, Gene said, I foolishly thought you could win. And I laughed and I said, you know, Gene, that is a sign of our collective naivete. But you know what? 3 decades ago, when the Federalist Society was founded, the missions of this organization were impossible to achieve. It took a bunch of naive idealists, oblivious to the realities of conventional wisdom, to do what we did to the law. And what I'm going to suggest to you is collectively, we need to do to politics what we've done to the law. Where has the Federalist Society gone in 3 decades? 3 decades ago, it was a very different legal world. This organization, you know, last night Gene was talking about the law schools that are now trying to shut down Federalist Society groups from even bringing in speakers. Why? Because we're winning the arguments. Because our ideas are right. Go back and read a statutory interpretation case from the 1970s. They begin with, we have before us this statutory question. The legislative history is as follows. Therefore, go back and read. You can't even, many of those decisions, you can't even find the statutory text in the opinion. Maybe it's a footnote. If you're interested in what statute we're talking about, here's the citation to it. Go look it up. Far more relevant is the subcommittee report and the comment that, you know, one member of Congress said on the subway on the way to get a cup of coffee. Originalism didn't exist. And what did this organization do collectively? We started making the arguments. We started making the arguments that law matters, that we have a constitution, that the constitutional protections matter. Read any statutory interpretation decision today. Everybody today starts with a text. They don't always follow it, but they at least start with it. For some, it is the thing to be gotten around. But at least they're acknowledging it's the thing to be gotten around. You know, go look at a decision like D.C. versus Heller. Now, I think that was a tremendous victory for Second Amendment rights. But one of the things that's striking, read the principal dissent. The principal dissent purports to be an originalist dissent. Now, it's very bad originalism, but what a statement of victory. That, in the words of the Parisians, we're all originalists now. That is a sign of what's happened in the legal world, that we have won many of these arguments. Now, it's not to say these fights are not still happening, but the legal world is transformed because of the men and women in this room taking a principled focus at winning the argument. And my view in the political world, you know, this is an organization that reveres the Constitution. I would guess if I asked the people in this room, how many of you would like to be a federal judge? Half the hands would go up. But that Constitution, look, the federal judiciary is incredibly important. It's, of course, in Article 3 of the Constitution. There's a reason the framers began with Article 1 and Article 2. And the courts and the political branches are inextricably intertwined. We may well see the consequences of this last election on our judiciary the next 4 years in a way that I think is highly perilous. You know, the press, after any election, in which Republicans don't do well. It always writes the headline, "The problem was those pesky conservatives." That was written before the election day was over. If only Republicans would become like Democrats, they would have won this election. In my view, the election results on Tuesday have one simple explanation. We didn't win the argument. Heck, we didn't even make the argument. Our country was built on foundational, revolutionary ideas. You think of the founding fathers who fought a revolution first with bayonets. And for the record, there are today more bayonets in the military than there were in 1960. But then an even more important revolution, a revolution of ideas. For millennia, we were told that our rights came from monarchs, that they came from kings and queens, and whatever we might enjoy were crumbs given by grace by the rulers. The framers of our Constitution inverted that entire concept of sovereignty. They began from the proposition that our rights don't come from a king or queen or even a president. They come from God Almighty. And the Constitution exists to protect those rights and to limit government, to serve, as Jefferson put it, as chains to bind the mischief of government. For millennia, there have been two ways of ordering a society. One based on free markets and entrepreneurship and individual responsibility, and that has consistently led to the greatest opportunity and prosperity ever seen across the globe. The other way is based on collectivism, government control, and socialism. And that has consistently, time and time again, led to shared suffering and misery. It is not accidental in the debates over Obamacare that not a single Democrat publicly pointed to any of the nations on earth that currently have socialized medicine and said that's what we want. Because the effect over and over again of putting it into practice, getting off the ivory tower, has not been pretty, has been rationing, has been poor quality, has been government bureaucrats getting between us and our doctors. But we didn't make that argument. Let me ask you, what was the high point of this presidential campaign? Without exception, everyone says that. The first debate between Romney and Obama. It's the one time we actually contested ideas, presented two viewpoints and directions for the country. And then inevitably there are these mandarins in politics who give the voice, don't show any contrast, don't rock the boat. So by the third debate, I'm pretty certain Mitt Romney actually French kissed Barack Obama. That day. And I have no doubt that there is a focus group somewhere of undecided Ohio voters who've lived in a cave for the last 30 years who decided they like that. Don't show any disagreement whatsoever with the president. Don't rock the boat. Just be a nice guy and have a personality contest, because those turn out so well for us. Our ideas work. Their ideas don't work. You know, even that first debate, I mean, how striking was it that when Mitt Romney actually pressed Obama, his response was, well, under Bill Clinton, there was great economic prosperity. It's a whole answer of Obama's all about Bill Clinton and how nifty the economy was under him. I got to tell you, I would have given a limb to see Mitt Romney turn to him and say, Mr. President, I knew Bill Clinton. our ideas work, their ideas don't. The last 4 years, our economy has grown 1.5% a year. That is less than half the historical average. For 70 years, we have averaged 3.3% growth a year. Now, this president is fond of saying he inherited the worst economy in the history of the universe. And everything, by the way, is George W. Bush's fault. He doesn't have much historical memory when he makes that argument. Any of y'all remember 1978, 1979? Double-digit unemployment, 22% interest rates, gas lines, stagflation. In 1980, a very, very different president got elected. Ronald Reagan, like Barack Obama, inherited a struggling economy. And Reagan implemented policies 180 degrees opposite those of Obama. Instead of jacking up taxes, he slashed taxes. Instead of exploding spending and the debt, he restrained the growth of spending. And instead of unleashing the hounds of regulators, by the way, when I think of regulators, I can't help thinking of Mr. Burns saying, "Release the hounds." Instead of releasing the hounds of regulators on small businesses and entrepreneurs, Reagan limited regulation, and the result was one of the most extraordinary bursts of economic productivity our nation has ever seen. The fourth year of Reagan's presidency was 1984, precisely corresponds to right now, the fourth year of Obama's presidency. Anyone know what GDP growth was in 1984? 7.2%. Our ideas work, their ideas don't. If you want growth, if you want jobs, if you want the 23 million people struggling to find work to get jobs, the answer is simple. You need growth. And to get growth, you've got to reduce and simplify the tax burden, reduce regulations, and unchain small businesses and entrepreneurs. It speaks volumes that over 50% of Americans who voted on Election Day believed the economy was George W. Bush's fault. There's a reason for that. President Obama said that every single day and twice on Sundays, and we never responded. Republicans were so terrified of uttering the words George W. Bush that we never responded. Let me give you another example. All of y'all are familiar with the, quote, war on women. The president, every Democrat, went throughout this campaign saying, Republicans want to take away contraceptives. What utter and complete nonsense. I don't know a single Republican on the face of the globe who wants to take away anybody's contraceptives. Look, my wife and I have two little girls. I'm thrilled we don't have 17. Not nearly as thrilled as she is. This attack was always deliberate mendacity. And by the way, we got the foreshadowing of it. Remember way back when, in the Republican primary, when George Stephanopoulos was moderating? As an aside, why on earth are people like George Stephanopoulos moderating Republican primaries? But if you remember, Stephanopoulos asked Mitt Romney, what's your views on the right to contraceptives? Now look, that wasn't an accident. I guarantee you that was the Democratic attack. We're going to say it's a war on women. Everyone scratched their head and said, what are you even talking about? Nobody was talking about contraceptives until they decided to cook up this attack. What the issue was really about, it wasn't too long ago that the Democratic Party was proud to have been the first major party to have nominated the first two Catholics to be candidates for President of the United States. What do you think an Al Smith or a John F. Kennedy would have said to a president who says to the Catholic Church, change your religious beliefs or I will use my power as president to shut down your hospitals and your charities. That is a radical view. That is an extreme view. It's never had anything to do with contraceptives, which everybody has a right to get, and nobody disagrees with that. This was always about government forcing Americans to violate their religious conscience. And yet, despite having an administration that took such a radical view, you know, the president got 50% of the Catholic vote. Got 71% of Hispanics, the vast majority of whom are Catholics. Did we even once make the argument in the Catholic community? We didn't make the argument, and if you don't make the argument, you don't win the argument. Now, going forward, my focus is in the U.S. Senate, unfortunately in the minority, are going to be working to cut spending, to push regulatory reform and tax reform, to get economic growth back. And what I ask each of you to do is bring the same creativity, the same diligence, the same thinking and passion that each of you has individually brought to changing our legal world. Bring it to the political discourse. If you want to change where we are, we have got to win the argument. As Margaret Thatcher famously put it, first you win the argument, then you win the election. And I look forward to working with each of you to do precisely that. Thank you.